resonating. And when we go out and we talk and we speak to people, we see that they are understanding that there is a change in the dynamics. The old parties want you to believe that to the right is the Republican Party, and beyond that is corporations controlling everything, and to the left is the Democratic Party, and beyond that is the state controlling everything. But those of you who are here for liberty, you know the politics is not a number line. It's not right and left. There's a third direction, a third dimension, and that is up. And up is the direction of personal liberty.
Welcome back to Liberty on the Air. My name is Ken Van Tassel, sitting in for Dan Fishman, who you just heard speaking earlier today at the Students for Liberty Conference, Northeast Regional Conference in New York City. He's out there rubbing elbows with the likes of John Stossel, former Governor Bill Weld. We wish Dan well, and we're looking forward to having him back next week. But thankfully, for my sake, we have Matt McLaughlin back in studio, keeping me company for 60 minutes or so.
Good evening, everybody.
Thanks for being back here, Matt.
My pleasure.
We've missed you the last few weeks.
Oh, stop it.
As always, you can text the show, 680-680, or give us a call, 617-266-6868. So one of the news items that broke kind of relatively recently, late last night, Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky was assaulted at his home in Bowling Green by a man who, quote, blindsided the senator, leaving him with minor injuries. And when I first heard this story break, you know, I had some concern, but it really got me thinking kind of in a bigger scope of things. And I wanted to ask this question to our listeners and to you, Matt. Has the divisiveness in Washington, the divisiveness between, you know, however you want to call it, the two political parties in America today, has that divisiveness led directly to an increased level of politically motivated violence against political figures in the United States that we haven't seen, you know, maybe in this modern era of politics?
I think it, I mean, I don't know if it actually has. It certainly almost seems that way. And I don't know if that's some of the 24-hour news cycle. I don't know if it's just the fact that we can't talk to each other anymore, which I guess would be, if you boiled it down to that, if it were true, I think the problem would be that we can no longer have conversations, it seems.
Right.
We're so divided. And I wish I could remember the actual fact. It was a poll taken like something like 2004 and then 2014, or it was like 2008 and 2014. Like, it wasn't a very long, although a decade is a long time, wasn't that long. And the difference in like the opinions, like you would think it was the, right, you know, like, oh, this is Republicans and this is Democrats. Whereas it was actually the Democratic Party had sort of like veered in certain ways. And to some extent, maybe the right has as well, but it just sort of shows how hard line people have gotten. And when you're that hard line, people seem right. Okay with being violent.
Yeah, I think I've seen that.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I think it was a Pew Research poll. Yeah. And it actually showed that over that time span that, you know, Republicans on average became more ideologically conservative and the distribution narrowed. And likewise for the Democrats. So the gap in the middle between, you know, elected Republicans and Democrats, that middle ground disappeared essentially.
Which is an interesting thing. I don't which to me says that, you know, as Dan was saying, there's sort of like a, you know, a third way, a third direction. I don't I think people are more attached to a party instead of an ideology.
Kind of proven by Trump, right?
I think conservatives actual conservatives, I think, are sort of bounded by that. I think progressives are sort of almost flavor of the month, so to speak, like whatever the current sort of thing is. I don't know how consistent they are. I'm sure they would believe they are consistent.
Right.
And to an extent, they have consistency. but as far as violence goes, we sort of live in a world now where we're in a country now where that's what we – that's – I mean, you hear like so many people talk about resistance to Trump that we have to overthrow him. It is all as this in these sort of violent or militaristic terms.
Right.
And it wasn't that long ago that, you know, people were, and they still sort of do, talk about like, oh, we can't show kids violent movies or violent video games or rap music. That makes people violent. So we have to do that. So if that were true, which I'm not saying it is, right. then why wouldn't all of this rhetoric create more violence from people?
Right. I think some of it is the amount at which the 24-hour news cycle is reporting all of these things, and it's always the top issue. And it's funny, you know, you just mentioned violent video games. I think both sides like to scapegoat the other side, right? Republicans will say, for a time, a lot of them were saying violent video games are what's causing, like, violence from younger Americans. And then the Democrats will say it's access to firearms. It's the Second Amendment's fault that there is more violence. And they don't see the irony of the fact that they're both pointing the finger at each other as the reason why there's something wrong.
There's something that is using the opportunity, of course, is what we do. I mean, I think the thing that sort of gets me the most is it's never about anything. It's not about you being right or you having principles now. It's about the other person being wrong. It's more important. It's not as important to be right or consistent. It's just important for someone who you don't like to be wrong. And with that, I think we're creating sort of like villains. Like, we have to take these people down. Like, I don't know what happened. I mean, I don't know, and I don't know if anyone knows what the situation with Rand Paul, and I hope he's okay. That seems awful and doesn't necessarily seem random. I don't know what, you know.
Yeah, it was the news articles are very sparse on information. It seemed like it was definitely a directed attack, but the idea that it was necessarily politically motivated, I mean, it's likely. Yeah, let's go to Skippy on the line. Skippy, how you doing?
Hey, hello, guys. I was just, I was spurned on by, I heard Dan's little soundbite there, and it made me think. And I'm thinking that, I think there's a big thing, there's a big problem in this country, and people don't realize it. It's almost like it's a bag job with, you get Republicans on one side and those and the Democrats on the other, and it's like a line in the sand. But neither of them will accept libertarian ideas. To Democrats, they're screwballs. To Republicans, they're screwballs. Yet they'll talk about freedom of speech and all that just as a passing thing.
Right.
But if there was a way you could get that third party in there to break that up, it seems like a scheme. Like, they're telling us something, but they're all in cahoots with each other, and they really don't care about the freedoms that Washington and George Washington, which they wanted in this country.
Right.
And so, therefore, they put it on, they go, oh, it's just us, it's just us. But they say that the libertarians are nuts. But, you know, that's what we're taught. But it's wrong. It's wrong. If you think that they get nowhere, if you look in the last 40 years, it's just one big mishmash of crap. And you need to have, listen, no one should be far left, right or far left. And I think libertarians, hey, you can, everybody, these libertarians are all lefties, and they're this and that. I think you deal with each issue upon it. You have to be more liberal on some issues and right. more conservative on others. And that has to be promoted, and that's the unfortunate thing. We should have a libertarian party.
Well, thanks for this call, Skippy. I totally agree. And
yeah, you know, some very good points, as usual, from Skippy.
Yeah, I mean, if you actually go back and look at what Gary Johnson was trying to accomplish since his presidential campaign, actually with the help of former Governor Bill Weld, they're actually taking the fight to what they're calling the Commission on Predetermined Debates. It's kind of their funny moniker they're using. It's the Commission on Presidential Debates. They're the organization that decides essentially who gets into the presidential debate. And they're, of course, they're run by former chairs of the Republican and Democratic parties.
And they didn't let Gary Johnson in the last presidential election.
No. Yeah, that was, there was a, it was actually pretty interesting because there were some of their, some among the ranks, there was a little bit of noise amongst the ranks saying, you know, maybe we really should. But of course, at the end of the day, you know, the power, the powers at B were not going
to
let that happen.
And to an extent, I can honestly sort of understand that. I mean, there are other parties. I mean, they're big two that have been around for ages that have sort of dominated our political spectrum. I mean, many European countries have 4, 5, 6, 40, 698 political parties.
Right.
That then, when you know, in their parliaments, they have to sort of make coalitions, and it's interesting who gets that. Whereas we basically have two, but we also have. I mean, did anyone need Jill Stein at a presidential debate?
Right.
I mean, but also, I mean, but to.
But the argument from, at least from...
Well, I'll also say that, did anyone need 15 or 13 people at the Republican primary debates?
Right, right.
They didn't need that.
But the thing is, you know, parties should be able to set up, because they're a political party, they should be able to set up their own rules as to eligibility criteria for their primary process. So I have no issue with them saying you need to be at 2% in the polls, 3% in the polls, 5% to get onto our primary debate stage.
Yes.
But it's that main stage of all the nominated candidates that, in Gary Johnson's view, deserves more scrutiny as to who gets in. And like his argument was that the criteria should have been, are you on enough state ballots to potentially win the presidential race? Or are you on the ballot in all 50 states? Because, you know, Jill Stein was not on every ballot in all 50 states. Gary Johnson and Bill Weld were.
Yeah, what I was saying about the, I mean, I agree with you. What I was saying about the Republican ones, it's not so much the rules that they set. It was just too many people. So I sort of understand that.
But then you wouldn't have got those great
clips. Three people is not too many people for an actual presidential debate.
You would have gotten those great clips of Trump making fun of the guys on the ends of either side, you know, at the Reagan Presidential Library.
Which were fantastic. But there's also... I mean, obviously, they you know, you had Ross Perot, who took a bunch of, well, who...
Yeah, I mean...
Poll to an extent and may have flipped that election.
Well, yeah. The funniest thing about that is that the real statistical political junkies that have looked at that said that it actually made Bush win by a smaller margin. That it actually... kept it from being a bigger landslide with Perot in the race. That Perot actually took more from the other side. And that this whole idea that Perot is to blame is the spoiler effect. The idea that you take the spoiler effect, you blame...
Oh, yeah.
The person that loses is always going to blame anyone else in that race. You know, we saw that with Dan when he ran for Congress, of course. This idea that somehow those votes are belong to someone else.
I just think that when you've got... I can understand sort of limiting some of the presidential debates, but you've got two guys on a party that is there, and they're on every ballot, and they've both been governors. Like, it's
right
to me, that makes it a little sketchier of sort of kicking them out. But obviously, I think the Democrat and the Republican Party didn't want they wanted that fight to be there. They didn't want it to be anyone else, and that's why they weren't allowed in there.
All right, coming up, we're going to be talking to Amanda Orlando Kesterson. She's the chair of the Gloucester Republican Town Committee. Also a member of the Mass Republican State Committee. We're going to be talking to her about upcoming city and special elections happening this Tuesday. Don't go anywhere. Well, welcome back to Liberty on the Air. Joining us now on the phone is Amanda Orlando Kesterman, chair of the Gloucester Republican Town Committee and Massachusetts Republican State Committeewoman. Amanda, thank you much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Amanda, there's a, you know, for a lot of people... that haven't been paying too much attention, there is a set of city, local, and some special elections coming up this Tuesday. I know turnout for these kind of elections are historically pretty low, but this cycle I'm even finding it astounding as to how few people know if there's an election happening in their community or not on Tuesday. What kind of things are you doing to try to get that word out that people should be getting involved in these local elections?
Well, that's a good question, and it's actually really, you're right. It's very sad. In here in our city, in Gloucester, our mayor is, she has an opponent, but it's not a race which is highly contested
right
at all. And so it generally means when there's not a highly contested mayor's race at the top of the ticket, people are less clued in to the election. And that is happening in cities and towns across the Commonwealth. And so it's too bad. What we're doing in Gloucester is there's been a series of debates that have been held. And what I've done is attend them all, post about them on social media, send out to my email list that they have a debate is happening, encourage the people on the list to come to it, and then follow up with them in regards to what happened at the debate, the positions people took, because a lot of people mean to get involved and they, you know, they think about it, but then they don't actually get to the point where they show up, and then they're unaware that there are candidates taking positions which are, you know, counter to what they believe.
Right. Yeah.
And so that's an important part, is we have to tap into, for the voter, hey, you know, these people are taking positions that are going to affect your life on issues, and you need to be clued in. So I just try to promote that as much as possible.
Amanda, I think that's great that you do that. What is the, I mean, it doesn't sound like the feedback or the response has been great. Do you get a lot of people? Do people, are there any people who show up to these debates that, that it wouldn't have otherwise?
Yeah, the same crowd tends to attend the debate in person, but here in Gloucester, they actually put them all on TV on our local cable channel, which is really great, because there are a lot of folks that have been contacting our, my brother is actually one of the candidates running for city council, so he gets a lot of feedback. You know, I saw you on TV.
friend of the show, Joe Orlando, right?
Exactly. Yep. So, you know, we actually laugh because I never watch local cable,
right.
really, and a lot of people don't. But the elderly do.
Sure.
And they're home, and they do pay attention to the local cable station. And so we've actually been gotten calls. Our mom actually got a call.
You're gonna make an app for it and stream it over something.
Well, that's what
right.
I'm thinking is, you know, in today's world,
even though every one of those things is streamed over the internet.
Well, in today's world, you really have to attack it from all the different media angles, because you know,
you do.
The younger people are never gonna watch the cable access news, but if the elderly citizens are getting their information that way, that's important. But
well,
you've
right,
also got to be on social media, like you said.
But
right,
I think,
and the local cable station also is running clips of the debate and putting the whole debate on social media. And then, you know, they've been putting it on my Facebook page, and then I take clips of it and run them on my page and others. So it's a way, it's just a way to reach out to voters as much as possible, remind them, hey, it's coming up. And of course, there's also the door-to-door effort. We've been going door-to-door for weeks,
right?
You know, and today earlier today we were doing the same. You know, don't forget it's Tuesday.
Yes, man. I live in Boston, and we have a mayor election coming up. We've had you know, this mayor for a few years, and I don't think I would have known about any of this because no one seems to be covering it except for all of the flyers and postcards that go into my mail every day. How much this is sort of a concerted effort by whoever actually is mayor to not have people come out and vote, which is sort of like, which is not great to, you know, not want people to exercise their right. And how much of that is like, well, no one really cares anyway, so why waste the energy?
Right. So campaigns aren't going to spend money if they don't feel like it's worthwhile. And a sitting mayor who doesn't feel threatened is not going to go out and spend, you know, thousands of dollars on mailing and reminding people to go vote in an election that is not going to benefit that person. And so, unfortunately, and that's a sad reality, and people get lulled into complacency. It happens all the time, which is why incumbents get reelected over and over without people knowing that it's happening.
Right. Yes.
And all of a sudden, some people have been in office for decades, and we were unaware of how it got to that point. So, you know, it's unfortunate. I think some campaigns do. They want lower voter turnout, particularly if you're, you know, in a position where you stand to lose the office if a higher voter pool shows up. So it is too bad. You know, I don't know. The only way around it is just to remember that if you are seeking to get your name out there, you have to, it's incumbent upon that campaign to do that in any way they can. And the more they are active and focused on the voters and doing voter outreach, the more people are going to be clued in and caring about showing up to vote.
Awesome. With the few seconds we have left, Amanda, if you want to plug where people could find out a little bit more information about Joe's campaign if they're listening in the Gloucester area.
Absolutely. So his name is Joseph Orlando. He's running for re-election to city council at large for a second term. He has a website, Joseph Orlando Jr., JR.com. And all his positions on the issues facing the city are there on his website. A lot of council orders he's filed, initiatives he's taken in his first term are there. You can learn more about Joe. You can also contact him. Just a reminder that the election is Tuesday, November 7th. Polls are open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. And we're urging everyone to vote Orlando.
Awesome.
He's the youngest guy on the slate. He's motivated. He's a family man. He's a great addition to the city council. We'd love to see him get another term.
All right. Thank you so much, Amanda, for your time. And I wish you the best of luck this election cycle.
Thank you so much. Have a good night.
After the break, Elizabeth Warren agrees the DNC is rigged. But does she really think a Tom Perez's run DNC will put a stop to it?
We learned today from former Democratic National Committee Chairwoman Donna Brazile that the Clinton campaign, in her view, did rig the presidential nominating process by entering into an agreement to control day-to-day operations at the DNC. The Clinton campaign controlling the party's staffing, strategy, finances, communications, and that agreement was entered into in August 2015, a year before she defeated Senator Bernie Sanders. This must shock you.
Look, this is a real problem. But what we've got to do as Democrats now is we've got to hold this party accountable. When Tom Perez was first elected chair of the DNC, the very first conversation I had with him is to say, you have got to put together a Democratic Party in which everybody can have confidence that the party is working for Democrats rather than Democrats are working for the party. And he's being tested now. This is a test for Tom Perez. And either he's going to succeed by bringing Bernie Sanders and Bernie Sanders representatives into this process, and they're going to say it's fair, it works, we all believe it, or he's going to fail. And I very much hope he succeeds. I hope for Democrats everywhere. I hope for Bernie and for all of Bernie's supporters that he's going to succeed.
Very quickly, Senator, do you agree with the notion that it was rigged?
Yes.
That was Elizabeth Warren speaking with Jake Tapper on the CNN network on Thursday.
One of the few true things she's ever said, by the way.
That was Elizabeth Warren. You know, let's step back. That was Elizabeth Warren agreeing that the DNC system was rigged in favor of Hillary Clinton and her campaign.
Which is interesting. I mean, well, she was a Bernie supporter to begin with. I think she sort of kind of felt she may have needed to support Hillary because they're both women and yada, yada. But I think, she's obviously more to the left of Hillary.
Sure.
Although, really, where is Hillary on any sort of political spectrum? She's on the Hillary side of it, no matter what the issue is.
Yeah.
And to
catch our listeners up, though, in case they don't know, the former chair of the DNC, Donna Brazile, said in her book that's coming out that the DNC entered into an agreement with the Clinton campaign as early as August of 2015, nearly a year before she defeated Sanders for the primary, for the nomination. The Clinton campaign, per that agreement, had control over day-to-day operations of the DNC, including staffing, strategy, finances, and party communications.
I think my favorite thing about that is that apparently the agreement said that, hey, you can go into this agreement with other people as well.
Right, yeah.
So someone else can run all of the finances?
Yeah, well, the more people they have, then they'll just, split it up and throw darts and see who gets the
Well, I guess the agreements aren't necessary. I mean, to some extent, an agreement between a candidate and the party is not unusual.
No, it's
to be sharing
not.
Resources and stuff. Whereas this one, basically, it seems, according to Donna Brazile, that it was they basically ceded everything over to Hillary and her campaign. The idea was that she was going to use her name and raise money for the DNC and also in the local sort of areas, but then she basically took all of that money.
Right. And you can't necessarily blame the DNC for, wanting to take advantage of her campaign to try to raise money for their own coffers.
Well, they were in debt. They were down some money. I mean, what people don't sort of realize is that one of the things that Obama did during his presidency, he had sort of like his own sort of like shadow company. I mean, not really a shadow company, but like normally the, you know, president is head of that party and
they had the legal maneuvering
fundraising, but he had like the Obama, I forget what he called it, the Obama
something
Foundation.
Something like an action fund or something like
that. Yeah, and so he wasn't raising money, and that sort of left, like, people think it was a great, wonderful 8 years of the Democratic Party for the DNC, and it really wasn't. I mean, they lost, right, like 1,000 sort of local sort of elections in those 8 years and such and such. And
but if you're going to talk fundraising, you know, love him or hate him, or love his politics or hate his politics, President Obama got people excited about that race, especially in 2008. And so there was motivation from Democratic donors at all levels of, you know, affluence.
Harvey Weinstein was ecstatic.
He loved giving, you know, millions of dollars.
And getting other people to give money.
But did the Hillary campaign really excite anybody, even like longtime Democrats? Was there anything exciting about her campaign that really got people out?
I mean,
saying,
the loss,
I need to give money out of my pockets.
Exciting.
Well, she doesn't actually know that she's lost yet. I'm not sure.
No, she's. I mean, yeah, no. I think to your point that no, I don't think anyone was really excited. I think people just sort of saw it as, I mean, sort of her birthright at that point, right? I mean, she was next in the line. She was, you know.
And Bernie was in the way.
Yeah, and I always thought that the Bernie thing was sort of like a polite sort of nod. I mean, I always, you know, to some extent, I thought it was a little weird that here's a guy who's not even a Democrat. He's always been like an independent. He's not really part of the Democratic Party.
Sure.
I mean, with caucuses with them and stuff like that. So, and they don't have to. I mean, they don't have to let him run on their party, which makes complete sense. But I think they sort of, my thought was always that they did it just to sort of be like, oh, okay, she'll have something. There'll be some talk. I mean, there was also Martin O'Malley. There was a couple of other people who sort of ran that sort
Lincoln
of like.
Lincoln Chafee, former governor of Rhode Island.
Yeah, does anyone ever remember any?
Was in the mix for a while?
Like, they were all done by like.
Oh, and there was that one other candidate. I can't remember his name now. I think he was from a southern state, but he had one of the best quotes. But now I can't remember it. If you remember that, who that was, give us a call.
Yeah, please, somebody.
617-266-6868. But I want to get back to Warren's quote from that interview.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Jake Tapper says, you know, this must shock you. And you notice that she does not address the fact that whether this was surprising to her, because she's not an idiot when it comes to understanding how the DNC works. She knew from the get-go that this is how the DNC is going to operate with the Hillary Clinton campaign. And actually, part of her brilliance, whether you like her or not, was her ability to kind of walk the line of her progressive street cred, so to say, of Bernie supporters, but also kind of towing the party line at the same time, because she, you know, she wants hers in 2020. She wants to have a crack at Trump.
Oh, Lord help us.
She wants her crack. But I mean, she's not naive to the way the DNC runs.
No, but it's what's fascinating is the fact that she did sort of admit it, which is sort of, had that question been 6 weeks ago, let alone 6 months ago, I don't think she would have said it was rigged.
Right.
I think she would have. I mean, I think, and I don't know if the, you know, the It's Everyone But My Fault book tour that Hillary's on.
Well, apparently everyone's trying to get in on a book tour right now.
And I don't know if that just isn't sort of resonating, or if the
I don't think a sore loser tour would resonate with very many people.
It really shouldn't. But you know, maybe it's just their way of saying you're done. You know what? Like, you know, thank you. You know, so long and thanks for all the fish. You know.
Yeah. Let's go to Al in Haverhill. Al, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going? How's it going, guys?
How's it going?
Great, Al.
All right, to answer your question, first question.
Sure, yeah.
That was Jim Webb, who used to be Republican as Secretary of the Navy, and he's action writer. So that was the guy who was also there running back last year.
That is absolutely good. Correct. Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you.
But, you know, to answer your question, I mean, I'm a Republican, but the worst person you can get to talk about elections is a member of the Republican State Committee, given the fact that they don't invest in local elections. If you look at the Democratic Party 2 years ago, recruited close to about 40, 50 Latinos to run, and the number of elected Latinos went from 22 to 60. There are now more elected Latinos elected across the state than are Republicans in the legislature.
Right.
So the question that should have been asked is, why doesn't the GOP invest in municipal elections?
Sure, yeah.
Because that will help drive up interest, but they have no interest because the only office they want to win is the corner office.
Is the GOP, what do you think? What do you think, Al? Is the GOP in Massachusetts just physically too small to kind of pull that kind of stuff off? And, you know, they're busy fighting for what they can get their hands on, which is, you know, once in a while is the governor's office.
Well, you know, the reality is that the GOP is led by people who are highly incompetent. I mean, you have a party chairman under her watch. She's also the city council president of the Quincy City Council. Under her watch, the first black and the first Asian was elected. Her excuse is, well, Quincy is a diverse city, so you can't find a conservative black or Asian. That's a bunch of BS. They don't give people an incentive to come out to vote. You know, that's part of the problem. There is no incentive. It's not that they're small. It's that they're inept.
Okay. Well, I'm not disagreeing with Al.
Yeah, no, Al seemed to,
I don't
like,
think I
knew a lot more.
Yeah, Al knows more than I do about the inner workings of the Mass GOP.
And yeah, good, Al, thank you for the call. That was great. It's good to have someone who is sort of knowledgeable about that.
I do agree that the sentiment around the Mass GOP is that they're not doing enough. And if you really think about how do you grow a smaller party, you know, in a state like Massachusetts where there's one party rule, you know, the Libertarian Party is thinking about the same kind of things. Obviously, they're still even smaller than the GOP in Massachusetts, but you really need to start by working your way up. And where do the farm system, so to say, for state legislative races, you know, a newcomer to politics does not typically have a chance at winning a state Senate or a state House race.
No.
Unless they're extremely well-funded or they're really, really well-known for some other reason. The farm system, these Democrats that are getting in first time in the House, you know, they've been school committee members for 10, 15 years in their local communities. They are groomed by the Democratic Party of Massachusetts. The GOP obviously has a smaller field to play with in general in Massachusetts. But are they putting in the work that's needed to farm up these people to run for these next offices? All right, let's go to Scott. Hey, Scott, how you doing?
Yes, good evening, gentlemen. Massachusetts politics, I'm totally disillusioned with. I will absolutely not even bother. Let's be very frank about it. Number one, if you're not a Democrat, you've got three strikes against you. Number two, if you're not Irish Catholic and you're running for office, you've got three strikes against you. And if you don't believe me, Mayor Walsh is going to win the election in Boston, hands down, because that's the way Massachusetts politics runs. And on the national level, it's the same idea. Democrat, Republican, it's garbage because they don't care about your vote. At the end of the day, Goldman Sachs and Bear Stearns controls an AIPAC. American Israel Public Affairs Committee controls how people vote. That's how rotten politics are.
So, Scott, we lost you, Scott. I was going to ask you, feel free to call back in, but I wanted to ask you, what can we do? You know, I know there's plenty of people that I know that are
I think there
politically
is
active who say it's not worth doing anything because, you know, it is all rigged, but not necessarily rigged, maybe predetermined. The mass of voters are going to vote for Marty Walsh. So there's absolutely no point for trying. And I'm sympathetic at times with those kind of people because I see the frustration of we can't get anything done because there's just not enough people that think like us to get one of these people to win.
But there are, I mean, obviously I think there are people that think that way. You know, there are people who, you know, they just can't always coalesce behind the same person. But I do wonder if it is sort of a chicken and an egg thing. Like, I don't necessarily, I mean, Tito Jackson is a known commodity. He's not some random guy who's just stepping in and be like, hey, I want to be mayor.
He's a sitting city councilor.
Yep. I mean, same as Marty Walsh was. But, you know, Marty obviously wants to be mayor for like 20 years. And like, I just sort of had no idea that there was like an election.
Yeah. Are you even seeing like those little signs they put up, around that say Election Tuesday, come vote?
I haven't seen any of those.
See, I've seen a few of them. There's actually a special Senate primary in my district for a seat that was vacated by Jen Flanagan, who actually took the position to be on the new marijuana board commission. I forget what it's called. So there's actually a primary, a special primary happening. And there's like maybe six or seven of these happening around the state on Tuesday.
And no one knows.
No.
Which is obviously, I mean, politicians always love to talk about getting the sort of the vote out and stuff like that. But, I mean, I don't know how much they really care because, I mean, they want their jobs. And I'm not trying to be negative or conspiracy theory. Like, I mean, if you want your job, if you're doing a good job, I mean, you just want the most votes of the people who cast it.
It doesn't have to be conspiracy. It's, you think about, you know, the incentives. What's the incentive for them? If they need the votes to win, they're going to try to get out the vote.
Well, here's the other thing.
If they don't, they won't.
A totally sort of left field thing. Like, I don't want the guy who's in office spending too much time
trying to get reelected. Sure.
I want him doing the actual job he was elected for. And the more time they spend doing that, the more time they're... Although with some of these people, maybe they should just be running for reelection or not doing anything. But...
Well, kind of the argument would be that how well they do their job is kind of will prove to be their reelection material, so to say. You know, it's like, how did you perform well? Do people think you're doing a good job? That should be enough. All right. When we come back, has the usefulness of daylight saving time run its course? And are we better off moving Massachusetts to Atlantic time zone year round?
The voice of Boston is you. On WRKO Boston, 93.7 WEEI HD2 Lawrence, Boston. It's 12 o'clock midnight.
Nice try, Will. Nice try, Will. Nice try. You're trying to cut a show short. That's really nice.
Was that just a weird time jump? Did daylight savings just jump 7 minutes?
Yeah, that's not the standard jump, Will. I mean, daylight savings time. But is upon us once again. Will's trying to do it for us, but it
very
doesn't really
clever
work that way.
Segue.
If you're listening to our show live, though, you should be sure to set your clocks back 1 hour before you head to bed after enjoying the last few minutes of our show.
Or if you have a cell phone, just let that do it automatically.
Or if you have a microwave, just let it keep blinking, and eventually it'll be right.
This is a fun story. I bought an alarm clock years ago that automatically switched for daylight savings time. It was fantastic, but I bought it like a year and a half before we switched to daylight savings. So I went from having to change a clock twice a year to having to not change a clock and being excited about it, and then having to change it four times a year.
Yeah. But perhaps daylight saving could be a relic of the past that future generations will only hear about in the folklore of their old parents' memories. The Massachusetts legislature directed a special commission headed by Lowell Democrat State Senator Eileen Donahue to study the issue of moving Massachusetts from the Eastern time zone to the Atlantic time zone year-round. Now, that report that was released Wednesday with a 9-1 vote in favor of ditching the clock-setting routine and sticking to daylight saving time all year-round. This proposal crafted from around the state said that Massachusetts would reap both economic and public health benefits should it move to the Atlantic time zone. Is this a good idea or a bad idea, Matt? Matthew?
I don't care. I think I'll be fine with it. I mean, the truth of the matter is we're, especially in Boston, like we're as like as far east in the Eastern time zone as you can be, which sort of screws with the light and the daylight savings time. I think people make. I mean, I'm sure there are some like health benefits, but on the other side, like people, it's an hour. I mean, if you can't deal with that hour change, never travel.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's people dealing or not dealing with it, but I think it's
if we all decide
statistically, your body, some people will be affected by it and actually be more susceptible to, you know, a heart attack. It's not that they can control that. You know,
yeah, but that would happen if they travel to a different time zone and all of a sudden their body thinks it's they're used to it being 3 p.m., but now it's 8 a.m. or something. You know, I mean, it's I'm fine with getting rid of it.
There is one kind of issue, and they kind of addressed it, is that Eileen Donahue said, if a majority of other Northeast states,
yes, this is big,
including New York, move to the time zone, then we will agree to do it too. Now, because that could be some pretty big issues if all the neighboring states aren't. I mean, I know some places like Arizona, I believe Arizona does not observe daylight saving. So if you live in a neighboring state and you might drive through, you have to be conscious of sometimes they're an hour ahead, yes, an hour behind. But actually, I know a few people that actually yet live out in Nevada that you kind of used to it. You know how to schedule your life. You know, oh, if you're going here, you need to worry about an hour. So I don't think that's that big a deal.
Yeah, I mean, like having to schedule a life, like maybe going to bed an hour earlier or an hour later twice a year to deal with the hour time switch, because that's so much more difficult. The big thing for me is I just want to make sure that like all of sort of at least New England or like, you know, New York, everyone does it. I mean, the whole country can go off daylight saving times. I'm fine with that. The whole planet gave it up. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah, I mean, it's run its course as its usefulness. You know, I think, you know, the original idea from Ben Franklin was a great idea at the time. You know, we could use more daylight at certain times of the year, you know, to get up early, get our farming done before we have to pen our letters by candlelight. But, you know, today's modern society, people don't need it.
But the other thing is if people really have a problem with it, if there's a lot of other businesses and stuff, then they can switch. They can go have their people work 10 to 6 instead. Let everyone sleep in an extra hour. Have them change and let them sort of exist on that, you know, not have them do that. And then everyone would be fine.
But this whole conversation actually kind of makes me step back and go, isn't it crazy how, like, society can be all defined and brought together by this time scheme? Like, how important is it that this time aligns so that people can conduct business meetings, people can have jobs?
It was only because of trains. it was only because each town.
Once you could travel far enough to
each town set their own time. Like, noon was when the sun was highest, and it didn't matter because when you traveled, but because of trains, where you had to go, where this. Well, the math problems you took in junior high, like when a train left New York, it had to be, when it was in Chicago, you had to know the time. So people had to be like, oh, this is the time that I need to go to be on that train.
Right.
So, but now no one uses trains, so maybe we don't need clocks anymore.
So if you're listening tonight and you set your clock back and you suffer some health ailments because of it, just listen to Matt and blame trains.
That's right.
And with that, we thank you so much for listening to another episode of Liberty on the Air. You can check us out anytime, libertyontheair.com. We'll catch you next week, and we'll have Dan back with us.
Good night, Skippy. Thanks for calling back.
People talk about sin taxes. The government taxes cigarettes because it says smoking is bad, and they want less people to smoke. The government taxes alcohol because it says drinking is bad, and they want less people to drink. So why is the government taxing income? Join that discussion and lots more, and listen live to Liberty on the Air with your host, Dan Fishman, every Saturday night at 11 p.m. right here on The Voice of Boston, AM 680, WRKO.